This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Inspecting schools in Kisumu County Monday, Education Minister George Magoha said the government would disperse $180 million to schools to make sure learning continues after a 10-month closure due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
That is Mohammed Yusuf reporting on Kenya's plan to fully open schools. Details coming up. Also, South Africa faces new challenges in the fight against the coronavirus. And courts in Malawi have started imposing stiffer penalties on perpetrators of rape and sexual abuse. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Kenya's plan to open primary and secondary schools next week is getting resistance from the leading teachers association, which says the schools are not well prepared to follow health protocols to prevent the spread of coronavirus. They say the schools need at least double the space they had before COVID-19 to keep children safe. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Some 16 million Kenyan children are expected to begin classes Monday after being out of school for nearly 10 months due to COVID-19 pandemic. Nicholas Gathemia is a chairman of Kenya Primary Schools Head Teachers Association. He says schools will find it difficult to follow health protocols meant to fight the coronavirus.
The facilities we have are not adequate. They are inadequate to maintain the issue of social distance. We need about 3 or even 4 times the number of classes that we have. And right now we are facing challenges with the grade 4 and grade 8. And I think if the rest of the schools turn out or come back, it will be a big, big, big challenge.
In October, Kenya reopened schools for students in grade 4, 8 and 12. The students in those grades are preparing for final exams. With a limited number of students, schools were able to spread out the classes to keep learners safe from the virus. Inspecting schools in Kisumu County Monday, Education Minister George Magoha said the government would disperse $180 million to schools to make sure learning continues after a 10-month closure due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Please use the money for the purposes for which it is meant. This is not the time for anything else. We shall follow by doing due diligence. In the past, we allowed everybody just to spend money without due diligence. Starting January 2021, that shall be our policy.
However, Gathema says the $40 million being given to primary schools is not enough.
That's a normal capitation that is even inadequate, has always been inadequate to maintain a school. For example, in a primary school, we just get... In annual, you get about 608 per child of the whole year. And when you talk of 50%, it means that you might get 300 shillings this year, about three at this term. And that 300 will be for the subordinate staff. It will be for all that work is needed in school. It is actually very, very true.
Kenyan schools will be required to do more, provide clean water for washing hands, hand sanitizers and face masks to keep children safe in the learning institutions. Tomkins Baraza is a high school teacher and comments on education issues. He says opening schools provide both opportunities and a challenge for students.
We shall have very few indiscipline cases. Indiscipline cases will reduce, i.e. drug abuse, pregnancies, as many of them, of the learners will be in schools where we have rules and regulations and a lot of guidance and counseling from teachers. Then the teachers will also have a great challenge whereby they'll be dealing with the many learners. And you might find that some of those learners might come with this pandemic to school and spread to others.
Since the partial reopening of schools in October, 35 schools have reported positive coronavirus cases and at least 2 teachers died of the virus. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
South Africa's government has imposed tough new restrictions to control the surge in the coronavirus cases. There is a strict overnight curfew. Most indoor and outdoor gatherings are banned, as are liquor sales. Opposition parties in South Africa are criticizing the government's decision to reintroduce harsher lockdown measures. More than a million people have been infected in Africa's second largest economy, and more than 27,000 have died. Darren Taylor reports.
The main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, says a hard lockdown should not be the only weapon in the state's arsenal at this late stage of the pandemic. DA leader John Steenhuisen says the only weapon should be a vaccine.
Many other countries around the world are rolling out the vaccine as we speak. Countries like Costa Rica, countries like Mexico, countries like Chile have started days ago with a comprehensive rollout plan on the vaccine.
But the countries he refers to have bought only small amounts of the vaccines available and have the technology needed to store them, which South Africa doesn't. Steenhuisen argues that even in the absence of a vaccine, the cost of the tighter restrictions is too great.
Lockdowns and bans may have short-term efficacy, but they have a hugely devastating impact long-term on the economy.
The government acknowledges the latest lockdown will cause untold damage to the economy, but says it will also save many lives. Science has shown that limits on movement and human interaction slow the spread of coronavirus significantly. Steenhuisen, though, says the state's failing South Africans.
Why is the focus not on expediting, spending whatever money we can throw at it, and getting that vaccine to our shores as quickly as possible, if only for the first responders in the first instance, and our healthcare professionals, and our teachers, but then a comprehensive rollout to the rest of the nation, so we can get our economy moving and we can get life back to some form of normality again.
But the two vaccines that are now being given in the US and UK need to be stored and transported at extremely low temperatures. Only a few South African laboratories have such refrigeration. Still, Steenhuisen says there are no excuses for what he calls the government's failure to secure vaccines.
And I think South Africans have got a serious question to ask their government, is that you keep asking us to sacrifice so much, our jobs, our livelihoods, our businesses, our investments, and yet you have no comprehensive timeline for us when the vaccine's going to arrive, which vaccine governments decided on, and what the rollout plan is.
Sources in the medical sector have told VOA the government's in advanced negotiations with pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson for the vaccine it's currently testing. The efficacy results are expected within weeks. Only one shot of the J&J vaccine is required. Others available need two injections 3 or 4 weeks apart. Health economists say a two-shot vaccination is not feasible and too expensive for South Africa. Cost is also a reason the country has signed on to the World Health Organization's COVAX facility. It will provide 92 middle and low-income nations with cheaper vaccines, but only later in 2021. Steenhuisen says South Africa doesn't have the time to wait for COVAX to kick in.
We seem to be part of this collective, when I would think that the best thing for us to be doing is to be getting out there like Chile, like Costa Rica, like Mexico, like Canada, like Greece, like Cyprus, and like Israel, and get the vaccine to this virus as quickly as possible.
However, these countries all have bigger economies and better infrastructure, allowing them to afford more of the vaccines currently available. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
As you just heard, the South Africa is grappling with a rapid surge in COVID-19 infections. Authorities warn hospitals are becoming overwhelmed. Earlier this year, in the midst of the first wave of infections in the country, we brought the story of a family hit hard by the virus and finding the medical system overstretched. We have been rerunning that series, and today we have the final part. Again, we have Darren Taylor reporting.
Fazila Abrams' 61-year-old sister Yasmin Hafiji, is in an intensive care unit, or ICU, at a private hospital in Cape Town. Her 59-year-old brother-in-law, Shiraz, was also there until he recently became yet another South African whose life has been claimed by the coronavirus. Abraham says doctors did not record the couple's medical histories when they were admitted with COVID-19 6 weeks ago.
So doctors started treating them without knowing the history. And I was dying to get to this doctor to say, she's an asthmatic, he's a diabetic, she's had colon cancer, she's had chemotherapy 7 years ago, he had a ruptured colon. They needed this information to manage them.
Doctors and nurses say they're under such physical and mental strain that they're making mistakes. The government says South Africa simply doesn't have enough hospital beds and staff to handle the flood of patients. It maintains it used a three-month hard lockdown to get hospitals and healthcare workers ready for all the COVID-19 cases. Abrams, herself a medical researcher, says based on her experience, the state and private sector facilities failed to achieve this goal.
In the ICU, people obviously are not well trained. They didn't use that bloody 3 months that we have to prepare our nurses to take care.
A very tight-fitting mask called a CPAP helps people with COVID-19 to breathe. Doctors say the apparatus works better when patients lie on their bellies.
She lied on her stomach for 2 nights. Extreme discomfort, but she said, I am doing this to get out of this ICU.
But while Hafiji got better, her husband got worse.
The reason he couldn't cope is this man had 2 operations on his stomach, and somebody had to tell them he can't lie in his stomach because he's got a massive hernia there still. They didn't recognize that.
Because of this, Abraham says her brother-in-law's symptoms intensified up until his death.
So imagine this is happening in a private hospital. Maybe it's not happening in our public hospitals. I hope not.
Abraham says for her, the COVID-19 experience has exploded the myth that South Africa's private healthcare resources are so much better than those in the public sector.
What worries me is that the private sector doctors are not as connected as the public sector doctors. Public sector, there's a team, there's ward rounds. And I think in the Western Cape...
State doctors have regular meetings to help one another to strategize against coronavirus by sharing information about patients. But in South Africa, private sector physicians essentially operate individual businesses and don't work as closely with colleagues. This, says Abrams, has fractured the private sector's response to the crisis.
Is there another Mr. Hendricks with similar symptoms in another ICU? What are we learning from that?
Abraham says her sister blames herself for Shiraz's death.
She's got huge guilt feelings about her husband because we believe she was ill first. That is traumatic at the moment.
Growing numbers of South Africans now have very personal stories to tell about how COVID-19 has affected them. It's only now, says the health minister, that the country is realizing the gravity of this pandemic. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
On December 10th, U.S. President Donald Trump's administration recognized Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara. It went on to declare that an independent Sahrawi state is not a realistic option for resolving the conflict and that genuine autonomy under Moroccan sovereignty is the only feasible solution. On December 21st, the UN Security Council, which considers the Sahara a non-self-governing territory, met to consider these developments. A UN Security Council resolution calls for a referendum to determine the final status of the territory. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, about these developments.
The United States is the first country in the world to make this determination, this declaration. None of the other 195 countries have made such a declaration, including the 60 or so that support the Moroccan autonomy plan, a few of which have put consulates in Western Sahara, but none of them have made a final determination. And under international law, that declaration by the U.S. has no bearing on other states, nor do their declarations have bearing on the U.S. Also, the U.S. has no legal standing to declare that another state is not a realistic option. So there are serious legal and logical flaws here. For example, Greenland and Mongolia and Australia have a similar population density. So if that was the U.S. argument, they would have to argue that Mongolia and Australia don't have a right to be states. But the U.S. didn't even state a position as to why they were making the declaration, other than that the Moroccan government had recognized the United States in 1777, but that was for completely different reasons. The Trump declaration did state twice that the old formula was that the Moroccan autonomy plan was serious, credible, and realistic. But nowhere does it say it's the only realistic or only feasible solution. The UN statement, therefore, is operative, and it's based firmly in the 1975 International Court of Justice opinion and the 1991 ceasefire agreement. Now, a unilateral declaration by a superpower does have geopolitical importance, and if the UN starts up negotiations again, it would only be by pressure from the greater powers of the world. There might be concessions made by the Moroccans. So it will be up to the Biden administration to figure out whether they want to take a more partisan position in favor of Morocco in the UN negotiations, or a more neutral position, such as the one that the U.S. is taking on Libya since the August ceasefire in Libya and before that. And that has geopolitical importance.
Would it be difficult for President-elect Biden to reverse the Trump administration's decision regarding the Sahara, which he doesn't have the force of law once he is inaugurated?
Legally, no. Under the U.S. Constitution, this is an executive branch decision about how to conduct diplomacy, you know, where to put a consulate or an embassy. And so legally, Biden can just undo that. However, Congress could create a problem for Biden by withholding funds or some other action that would make it this difficult. It's also possible that the Trump declaration violates international law. So even though under U.S. law, he can do this, international law does preclude him possibly from making such a determination without any argument or any presentation of why under international law he can do it. But geopolitically, it's very difficult for Biden because it's linked to the Abraham Accords. And so just like Biden will have to look at whether or not to keep the sale of F-35s to UAE going, whether or not dealing with Sudan and taking them off the terrorism list, and therefore the U.S. may or may not be able to make those determinations. Biden will be in a situation whereby he could slow walk what the Trump administration did as part of the quid pro quo related to normalization with Israel, rather than simply undoing things. And I think that's what he'll do.
Algeria has been the main supporter of the Polisario Front, but so far it seems that Algerian government is waiting for the new U.S. administration before it takes a stand on the Sahara issue. Would Algeria play a pivotal role in mobilizing the international community against Trump recognition of Sahara?
Yes, they've been doing so since the 1970s, and they will keep that going forward. They are waiting for the Biden administration, which won't take probably as forceful position as they want, at which point they will make the declarations, I think, that they haven't made yet. There are about 80 countries that used to support the Polisario position. That's dropped to about 60 with effective Moroccan diplomacy. And about 30 of those countries fully recognize the sovereign state, the Saharan Arab Democratic Republic, which is a full member of the African Union. And Algeria is the leader of the bloc that supports the SADR and its membership in the UN. So that will continue to be the case.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington. He spoke with my colleague, Mohamed El-Shenawi. Courts in Malawi have started imposing stiffer penalties on perpetrators of rape and sexual abuse. The move is seen as a response to calls from various rights campaigners who have been lamenting lenient sentences given to offenders. As Lamek Massina reports from Blantyre, rights campaigners say more needs to be done.
Statistics from the Malawi Police Service show that recorded cases of rape in the country have more than doubled Since 2018, figures from the National Statistics Office show that for the last 3 months of this year alone, sexual abuse cases have been 35% higher than the same period last year. Rights campaigners blame the rise on lenient penalties given to the perpetrators. Now, local media are noting a sudden trend toward longer prison terms for those convicted of rape and sexual abuse. They say the average sentence has jumped from 10 years to 20, with some perpetrators getting life imprisonment. For example, a high court in Lilongwe last week sentenced a 30-year-old man to life imprisonment for raping a 10-year-old girl and infecting her with HIV. This came a week after a court in Blantyre sentenced a 42-year-old man to 20 years in jail for raping his stepdaughter. She, too, was infected with HIV. Barbara Banda is head of Gender Coordination Network, an NGO which has been holding protests against rising cases of gender-based violence.
We are happy that we have gotten to this level where we can see the biggest punishment that can be given by the court. But what is worrying is that we continue to see the cases surface every day, which means that these sentences, they are not a complete deterrent avenues of addressing increased GBV and defilement.
Banda says the focus on should be changing mindsets that can cause sexual abuses. Some Malawians falsely believe that having sex with a minor can cure HIV or will somehow bring great wealth. Justice Zwone Ntaba is a judge at the High Court of Malawi and the National Program Coordinator for the Women Judges Association of Malawi, or WOJAM. WOJAM has partnered with other organizations to sponsor traveling courts so people can see justice being carried out with their own eyes. She believes this is important to deterring sexual crimes.
Apart from the stiff sentence, the biggest issue for us in terms of crime reduction is that ensuring that justice is seen when the crime is done, because that is what actually changes people's mindset. It's not necessarily just the stiff punishment. It's the aspect of seeing a person who's committed a crime go through the system and get convicted, and that will bring that mindset change.
Justice Ntaba says she also thinks rising cases of sexual abuse can also be reduced by investing in crime prevention measures. Malawi's Minister of Gender says it has partnered with various organizations, including Malawi Police Service, in a national awareness campaign against sexual abuse and gender-based violence. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyu Suwuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Aparo, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the interview.